Hello, listeners, and welcome to Cultural Mechanics. This is a podcast that emerges out of my research and interests in a variety of topics relating to digital culture, electronic art, critical media, creative technologies, the arts, the humanities, and of course, a whole lot more. For more, see culturalmechanics.org or follow me, James O'Sullivan, on Twitter at James C. O'Sullivan, or check out josullivan.org. So this episode won't have any interventions on my part. What you're about to hear was recorded at the Electronic Literature Organization's annual conference, this particular iteration being hosted at the University of Victoria in June. The speakers are Cathy Inman-Berens, Jessica Pressman, and Caitlin Fisher, and they are participating in a panel called Feminist Horizons. So just a minor FYI, the order of the speakers deviates somewhat from the order in which they are introduced by the session's chair, Anastasia Salter, with Berens going first, followed by Fisher, and then finally Pressman. Salter provides an introduction for the speaker, so I leave the formalities to recording. I will add that all four of the voices you are about to hear belong to highly respected critics and artists. And while it can be tricky to wholly appreciate audio that references visuals you cannot see, these talks are nonetheless extremely valuable, as I'm sure you'll agree. Enjoy.
Well, it's a little after time, so I guess we'll get started. So, thank you for coming to the feminism panel. This is kind of nice because the conference started off with a lot of feminist discourse this year, and then we had the keynote yesterday, and now we're ending on the feminism panel, and that's honestly, I think some of the most of this type of discourse I've seen at any conference in our field that isn't actually specifically the feminist version of the conference. So this has been very exciting. I'm thrilled to have our three amazing presenters today. So I'm just going to, you know, do the brief bios in advance, although honestly they need no introduction, and then we'll get started. So first up, we'll have Cathy Berens talking about towards the feminist theory of elit interfaces. And she's an assistant professor of digital humanities and book publishing at Portland State University's English department. And of course, she recently was a Fulbright scholar to Norway. Next, we'll have Jessica Pressman, an assistant professor of English and comparative literature at San Diego State University, who directs the Digital Humanities Initiative there. And she's the author of Digital Modernism, Making It New in New Media, and co-author of The Reading Project. And last, we'll have Caitlin Fisher up, co-founder of York's Future Cinema Lab and founder and director of the Augmented Reality Lab, which has amazing works with augmented and virtual reality. Well, thanks for joining us.
Hello, everybody. Yesterday, I had the pleasure of hearing Astrid Enslin's presentation on Wallpaper, a new interactive fiction by Andy Campbell. It's a pleasure because I've taught Astrid's 2014 MIT Press book, Literary Gaming, which seeks to provide a new framework for understanding the literary ludic spectrum in a technique she calls ludostylistics. Her model is more attentive to gradations of aesthetics and play than straight-up narratology, though her work acknowledges a debt to Marie-Laure Ryan and to the ludology associated with Espen Orsef. When I was in graduate school in Berkeley, I spent about a year reading narratology, trying to create a taxonomy that would explain a phenomenon I observed in 18th and 19th century novels. It didn't work, because I could always find elements of my consideration set I'd have to minimize or ignore in order to get my model to work. But the allure of narratology tugs at me still. Sort of like when Stewart said during his keynote yesterday, 2 days ago, that he'd been hanging out with formalists and it catches. His paper was one way to cough it out of his system. I observe in Nordic, Central European, and some British scholarship that narratology continues to thrive and never fell out of fashion as it did in North America. This might be because some literature departments are folded into science departments, media informatics, and the like. Narratology creates scientific taxonomies of literary behaviors. The best example of this kind of scholarship, certainly the most influential in our field, is Espen Aarseth's Cybertexts, A Theory of Ergodic Literature from 1995. In May 2016, Espen just received a 2 million euro advanced grant from the European Union's European Research Council to fund a 5-year effort to develop and quality assure some basic concepts for game analysis. So here I am, speaking in the first person in a paper that ostensibly poses a formal question. What are or might be the traits of a feminist interface in literary games? Which aspects of feminist theory might a formal practice mobilize in the pursuit of new information about the mechanism, dynamics, and aesthetics, the MDA, of how some e-literature works? Rather than adopt a formal model explaining outputs as Astrid does in literary gaming, in this paper today I'm documenting what I call a materially based reader response criticism that attends to interface as a performative apparatus. I propose that e-literature's literary game surfaces are unique because their material substrate is a place where play and reading, the ludic and the literary, co-mingle to such an extent that they are inextricable. The surface of electronic literature is the screen output, yes, but also it comprises the entire reading apparatus, from hardware to the software protocols that let that hardware run, to code, to screen output, to reader's touch, to cognition and feeling. The affective, material, and embodied, the highly situated and contingent aspects of a work are all aspects of interface. They're not scientifically discernible because the conditions of their making are not falsifiable or repeatable, but neither are they so subjective as to be formless. This paper explores the forms of interface in two e-literature works as a way of suggesting an alternate route to reader response criticism. So this is not your Stanley Fish reader response. My rationale for this dispersed method is that e-literature's interfaces are wildly heterogeneous. Even a minutely specified bot doesn't signify universally because the outputted tweets are served into different feeds, selecting and combining different variables and read at different times, or perhaps not at all, in the flotsam of anybody's stream. On the opposite edge, even a work like Dakota, which requires exactly one stroke of the keys to initiate and plays the same files every time, will vary a lot in its signification, depending on whether or not the reader knows Pound or Elvis, or for that matter, Jessica's book. In e-literature, readers must learn how to play each work uniquely on its own terms. Those terms are arrived upon collaboratively, a negotiation between human and non-human systems. This leads to the second premise of my paper, which is that e-literature interfaces are incunabular. Incunabula, Latin for in the cradle, is a term referring to the first 50 years of printed book experiments from 1450 to 1501, when the paratextual conventions that made books easy to read, margins, paragraphs, kerning, page numbers, title pages, were adopted through trial and error. Janet Murray mentions incunabula in Hamlet on the Holodeck when she talks about how new media forms imitate their predecessors until, through trial and error, they hit upon the unique capacity of the medium. The early film was transformed when D.W. Griffith invented the dolly, and suddenly film actors were freed from imitating stage actors on a proscenium stage. When DMA North, later known as Rockstar Games, invented the top-down perspective in Grand Theft Auto, it transformed playable space and perspective. When I say that e-literature is perpetually incunabular, I mean that its forms don't resolve into stable paratextual reading or gaming conventions. 30 years in, e-literature still doesn't have the paratextual conventions that would make e-lit easy to read. Of course, we wouldn't want it to be easy to read. The people drawn to this kind of avant-garde art relish its novelty, the puzzle solving, the witty play with the limits of software. But it also means that creating a schema, such as the literary ludic continuum that Astrid has populated, and that I'll show you in 2 seconds, is troubled by e-literature's incunabular, wildly heterogeneous interfaces. And I have to apologize to Astrid because I left my book, I left my copy of Literary Games at home, and so I couldn't scan. I wasn't planning to talk. I wrote this bit after I heard your talk yesterday, all of that bit. So I'm replicating a slide that I shot off of her slides yesterday. And so this is Astrid's data in all senses. But this replicates this important literary ludic spectrum that she's created. And what you'll notice, and I can't actually toggle over and point to it as I would if I weren't tethered to a microphone right now, is that this continuum that she's created posits on the one hand the ludic. Think about like Game, Game, and Again Game by Jason Nelson. And then the literary, think Dakota, where you're bringing close reading literary skills to understand that text. I mean, as one way of understanding that continuum. So I've chosen my case studies. I've chosen as my case studies two excellent works that make an unlikely pair. I selected them because they elicited from me such active reading, such imaginative engagement, that I felt my reading and play were recursive. I could no longer tell the difference between literary and ludic. Those seemingly distinct qualities of attention became indistinguishable. So I'm going to talk with you for 1 second about the works, and then I'll play them a little bit for you. Maybe I'll just show you something first. Okay, so this is the Upside Down Chandelier. So what you're noticing is that the words that flash across the bottom are in different languages. And that what you're hearing are phonemes, pieces of words, but not actual words, and not actually discernible as a particular language. I'm just going to turn this down a little bit so I can talk over it while it. So you'll hear a little bit of both of us, the machine and the human. On the surface of it, only one of these two works, and I'll show you Mark Marino's Living Will in a minute, is a literary game. Upside Down Chandelier by Maria Mencia, Zuzana Khosarova, Janine Nagy, and Christine Wilkes is mostly acemic artwork designed for live installation. In 2013, it was installed in a 19th century tobacco factory in Košice, Slovakia. It references an event connected with the history of Košice and its tobacco factory built in 1851, which employed mostly women workers. Some decades later, when the St. Elizabeth's Cathedral next door was being renovated, the women workers donated a candle chandelier. The chandelier itself was repurposed twice, from original candles to gas lighting, and with the advent of electricity, was turned upside down. In the installation, images of the chandelier from the cathedral are randomly generated and projected onto a screen in a flux of form. So what I want you to imagine is that you're in this beautiful brick tobacco factory. It's now a super cool art space. And what you're seeing are those images projected all around that space that you are physically in. So it's a grand space with that happening and the words flashing from two different projectors and the sound around you at all times. Simultaneously, the words connected with this story appear projected on the walls of the room, and phonetic sounds from Slovakian, Hungarian, and German are generatively mixed to create the soundscape of languages that were once spoken in the very same place by women workers. The web installation that I'm showing you right now is a playthrough meant to approximate liveness. So right away, the web version is a proxy for an experience that's inaccessible to us because it was ephemeral and precisely referential to a particular location and space and time. So I'm going to have to kill this because I can't. Well, I guess I could just turn the sound down while I show you Mark's stuff. Yeah, I'll mute it. Okay. So this is Living Will by Mark Marino. And you click to begin. And you can see that the game mechanic is apparent right away. You're instructed that it's never too early to tally your inheritance, and you're told that you hold in your hands the living will and testament of E.R. Milhouse, making you the controlling executrix, beneficiary, and heir. And we'll go into some of this language in a minute, but I just want you to get the kind of visual aesthetic of this UI. Maybe I should just read this piece to you. Okay. Mark C. Marino's Living Will, a browser-based hypertext literary game, features four characters who compete to collect the greatest share of the dying magnate E.R. Milhouse's considerable estate. Milhouse's first-person declaration of his living will is a set of instructions meant to stand for his intentions when he's incapacitated and can no longer provide informed consent. That's the surface story, the user interface. But his executable will turns out to be a telling pun. The story transpires on two levels, on the screen output, where it is a literary game, and in the code, where it is a tale of intrigue that includes a character who does not show up on the UI, and a mystery that we'll be talking about in a few minutes. On the UI, readers play from the perspective of one of Milhouse's four heirs in the game. Under the hood, they read, or one reads, the intrigues of the game of the characters in the code. The object of this literary game is to capture the most inheritance, which presents dilemmas both moral and mechanical. The object of this game in the code is to puzzle through the appearance of a mysterious character called Kizangi, and to test the extent to which the undumbed JavaScript library can yield hermeneutic style ambiguities that comment, ironically or otherwise, on the UI or on the reader's position in the relation to the characters. And what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to show you, I frequently read the source code of anything that's written in HTML. Last weekend, I was judging a hypertext contest, and I was noticing something strange about the UI, so I read the source and I discovered a bunch of broken links. I mean, some sound files that I thought were broken were actually just set at a really low sound level. So, I mean, I frequently will look at source code, and I saw, when I went to look through this work, I found something really interesting down here at the bottom that I don't typically see, and it's this line that says, /games/tutorial/lastwill.javascript. And that leads to this. And what you see here is something that visually marks itself as not simply executable code, but something that has story-like properties. And you can see that the code comments, including those dashes that set it off in kind of a stylish way, are meant to announce that this is a space of play. So it says, the insides of the living will of E.R. Milhouse, in this document you will find the imperatives that drive my will. If you are reading it, you have decided that the surface effects of my will are insufficient to satisfy your needs, and that you need to know what drives my logic, or perhaps my wish to encode your will. I know, it's witty. And then he says, a little tracking to see what the heirs are up to. And so he identifies that it's tracking code, and that's a more typical use of code comments, right? Like, here's the language that follows next. This is what this does. But then check this out. It says, within this code, you will find how ruling requires a frenzy of naming. And then the next line, umdum.game.id=MarkCMarino.com. And then semicolon. So I'll be coming back to that in a few minutes. Upside down chandelier can't be won. It would seem to be absurd even to propose it. There's no mechanic that prescribes how the reader will interact with the piece. There's no reward for doing anything particular. And actually, I'll just show you since we're back on that. There's no reward for this, for doing anything particular in its interface. Conversely, in Living Will, and it's kind of perverse that it's a literary game, and I'm not really going to play the game for you. I'm mostly just going to look at the code. But I'll let you go play and see if you can actually tally up a good inheritance. I'll tell you that the game rewards greed. It's a really cynical take on how heirs behave when they have something to inherit. So I'm going to mostly look at code. Conversely, Living Will screen output looks very much like a game. There's a dynamic point tally that converts reader action into portions of inheritance. There's a boss challenge when you play from the point of view of Milhouse's son, Kip. And progress through the story is measured against a final outcome where the reader chooses to save Milhouse or let him die. Thus, I've chosen to compare, or at least propose as adjacent, these two e-literature works because they would be at the edges of Astrid's model. In plotting Living Will, how to account for the code story and the game on the UI? Astrid and others working in ludology have two classifications that would apply. For Astrid, it would be code work or ludic hypertext. This work is both of those things. Do you separate them, even though the UI is the flesh padding the bones of the code? Do you average them, and so generalize or approximate their literary ludic status? And then with Upside Down Chandelier, it certainly was not created as a literary game, but in my experience, when I played it, Upside Down became one. You'll hear more about this in a couple of minutes. So I'm going to buzz through and just quickly talk a little bit about how this work became a game for me. What I did is I snapped screenshots and shoved them into Google Translate. And that was a way to take this work that's otherwise very hard to understand. I mean, my first encounter with this work, and it is, by the way, a 13-minute flash loop, I had no way of making sense of any of that. Like, that word is Slovakia, that one that just scooted across the bottom. So you have to actually interrupt the interface in order to read it. You have to take a screenshot, and then you have to use an augmentation. And in that case, it was Google Translate. So once I actually had that way in, it became a much more interesting work for me, and I was able to kind of trace an embodied feminist materiality in something that would not otherwise have made any sense at all. So I want to just say that in thinking through whether or not a feminist poetics of interface can be deduced from electronic literature and literary games, I found myself thinking about Orsef and the Greek origin of cybernetics, kybernete, which means to govern or control. If the interface is a meeting place where human and machine adapt to each other's capacities, then Wendy Chun's work on the ways in which screens screen suggests that the power relations obscured when GUI software stacks the deck in its favor moves users from grudging acceptance of its rules to feelings of mastery and eagerness when the rule set becomes internalized and naturalized, when it becomes, that is, an inalienable part of us until the app stops working or the network cuts out. And we notice the interface's foreignness once again. It's not unusual for literature to speak truth to power, to disdain conventional reward systems, but it is unusual for literature to perform such resistance at the level of interface, whether in code or a responsive UI. So now I'm just going to quickly talk about a couple moments in this code. And I'm going to take us down, like, effectively, because I did some rewriting last night, and my piece is slightly longer here than I want it to be, so I'm going to actually wind up in 2 minutes rather than the about five that I've got. So I'm going to just say that the unifying aspect of Living Will's UI and code surfaces is the contradiction of the speaker Milhouse's voice, the declaration of incapacity in the user interface, and his omnipotence in the code. The tension creates a different kind of literary game, related to but not identical with the classical one about discerning what's true and untrue in the speech of an unreliable narrator. But our sleuthing transpires in two different languages, English and JavaScript, which is encoded English that turns upon two things, declaration and strings. And I'm going to just note for you that declaration is the frenzy of naming. And there are a lot of fascinating declarations here in these different chunks of code. But we're going to go down and look at this one. You'll see that the speaker actually talks to characters. So Milhouse addresses characters here in the code comments. And we're going to go down to look at Kip. Kip is Milhouse's errand boy. But what we learn only by reading the code is that he's also Milhouse's illegitimate son, and that a family scandal is buried in the code in a way that is not really evident on the UI. So you see that Nigel is the first named heir, and then Salome, and then Kip. And then we come down here to younger Kip, early Kip. Okay, let's look at this. Actually, I'm going to take you here. So this character called Kizangi, who is this functionary who shows up only in the code, says, due to the variability of this process constructed as requested, this part of the will may not hold up to legal requirements of probate. And the variable strings, these are all the possible things that anybody, any of Milhouse's heirs could inherit. And they're pretty funny. Like one of the things is, you know, my unfinished international spy thriller, my diabetic tabby King Leo, a bunch of credit default annuities leveraged against the teacher's retirement fund of Sheffield, a slightly used Voles and Kengay legal pad, a half a dozen decapitated garden gnomes, and so forth. But the interesting line is that this is when the strings are made to combine. It says strings shuffle and then the operator. And then the really interesting thing is this. Extra strings attached dot shuffle. So the extra strings attached turn out to be the mom of Kip, who was brutally raped and murdered. She shows up only, like we meet her in one sentence, she dies in the next, she never has a name. And this woman who is in this text ends up standing as a figure for the Congo. This is an interesting post-colonial rumination, or rumination on post-colonialism. So as I conclude, what I want to suggest is that the work of talking about the literary and the ludic in electronic literature interfaces repays close reading. Although I am indebted to Astrid for doing this hard work of trying to discern ways in which the literary and ludic move in progression, I think that what makes the literary are those things that force it to stand outside of such taxonomies. Thank you very much.
So this, as just to echo Anastasia again, this is probably the most overtly feminist ELO conference I've attended. And a person new this year might think it was always this way, but at the risk of being in politic, I offer it doesn't always feel this way. It's a remarkable achievement, though. Three plenary sessions and keynotes in which feminist concerns were made central. This panel, which seemed really urgent last year and generally happens over coffee, now seems less urgent. So understand my comments here also exist in the context of gratitude and a mad, crazy love for this community, perhaps especially for the inspirational women who inhabit it and have shaped it from its beginning and continue to do so. I've rethought, as I said, my provocations a couple of times, even rethought them in the hour leading up to this moment, sitting at the back. And partially to make them more resonant with the important conversation that's already begun. So off the top, I've been trying to figure out, especially in the context of this year and all of the good, robust discussions and looking out at all the incredible practitioners, what I think is the paradox of feminist centrality alongside what I'm still going to name as its elision. I loved Anastasia's talk and welcome the opportunity to come at some of the same issues from a different angle, maybe a few different angles. It's obviously always urgent to theorize spaces and practices and to name places where we have unwelcome spaces and violence. But I'd like to come at the problem the other way around. what are women doing and what have they claimed? And it worries me a bit as the public-facing activities of ELO are rightly pulled into more robust discussion of feminism and intersectionality and practices and difference, and within a wider context of communities and practices which are so often overtly hostile, that the hidden history of our field as subversive and feminist risks erasure or taming. So bear with me, we can talk about this, why it seems on the one hand I feel strongly that both these things are going on. I also love the way Christine Wilkes' keynote explicitly discussed not just feminism, but this gesture to Virginia Woolf as a gesture to the political economy of women's creative opportunity. So my lens is not why don't women code, but rather why don't we value the things that women do and the spaces they make? And I do appreciate this has been part of the discussions, but it's just this is just what I have been preoccupied with. So I hope you'll indulge me when I kind of kick it old school. It's going to be short, but it's kind of just impressionistic. And I offer these thoughts in the spirit of just provocation and opening things up and in gratitude of having this space to speak. So my own doctoral work in the early 90s was on feminist hypertext and was precisely engaged with these kinds of questions. So, over 20 years ago, I was very interested in how the emerging discourse around hypertext functioned to render invisible the contributions of women that might have been mentioned in the rush to mobilize proto-hypertextual histories. There was no Zora Neale Hurston, no Rachel Blau Duplessis. Nobody was talking about the story quilting of Faith Ringgold. Nobody was looking back to, the webs of Faith Wilding at a time when we were thinking about influences. So that was sort of my work. And I really felt that a lot of critical early work was evacuated in favor of privileging amazing authors, but none of whom were women, none of whom were women of color. My doctoral work took methodological cues from contemporary, in that moment, hypertext and feminist theories. It was called Building Feminist Theory, Hypertextual Heuristics. And it made a claim for the productive coupling of hypertextual practice and feminist critical discourse. Rather than simply identifying feminist hypertexts and explaining them in terms of a feminist hermeneutic, the dissertation used feminist and hypertext theories to build a new kind of text, a text that sought a form homologous with eccentric knowledges. And implicit in the title was the claim that the process of shaping the hypertext was itself a form of feminist theory production, theory built both by the structure of the hypertextual dissertation and as an effect of reading. All that to say that for me, feminism and electronic literature are always inextricably intertwined at the level of theory. I came to the field at a time in which arguments were made about these being decidedly feminist forms. We used to hear this all the time and then we stopped. The daughter's circular pathway, the post-colonial speaking alongside, inspired by Trinity Minha. Even that moment of problematic but heady essentialism where Sadie Plant gets to say things like, think of the difference between DOS and Windows and you'll see that the future is female. We loved that. We hated that. Also at the level of practice, women were always in elite because women are always in those spaces that allow fragmented working, little startup capital. Women often arrive in large numbers in those spaces. Think poetry. And then they're made less visible. Think avant-garde. You could make a compelling argument that this field is women dominated, but that the area is favored by women in the same way that occupations generally fare when women enter them in large numbers, suffer loss in status. The dismissal, not at the level of anyone saying the work is not important, but at the level of intense evacuation and histories not being written about these practices, not being named. This is precisely why young feminists favoring Twine, I think, for example, just don't know that in at least one reading, mine, the entire first wave of hypertext is dominated by small stories, not all of them by women, but many of them aligned with classic feminist themes of recuperation and discovery, private spaces, confessional moments, sex, diaries, secrets, mysteries, braced against the appeal to universality and the machine. So avoiding universal themes in favor of kitchens and bedrooms is a classic feminist act. Building accessible tools to allow for diverse voices is a feminist act. And I do often think that the avant-garde is defined against the things women do. I'm not making a particular claim to this space or the need for my work to be understood as avant-garde. It's actually really interesting. I'll say one tiny thing. I won an award for one of my first AR poems, and I was delighted and surprised, and I knew it was an accident. It was for Andromeda in 2008, and it was a small lyric poem about a variety of women named Isabel, with whom the narrator is in love, and different moments, different Isabels. And it was designed as a sort of augmented reality pop-up book, and we'd been building the code, a very easy drag-and-drop code, so that it'd be easy for artists to make these poems. And the code wasn't ready in time for the deadline, and it wouldn't work. And as soon as the camera saw the fiducial, it would start the video clip, it would start the small song, but then it would not shut up. And the idea was that women's voices would sound fully, that every, you know, and what happened was it was just this cacophonous cascade of the voices that just erased the voices, that you know, and you could kind of hear little bits. And I thought, wow, I built the poem that I don't like to write. And I thought, this is going to do well. And and it did, because I just don't think that in the context of a digital poem, and I could be wrong. I mean, this is one reading that comes from a particular moment. It could just be that the way I'm thinking about this today. But I always thought, yeah, I think the small story of girls and desire and this moment of different women's readings was not the moment for digital poetry. It was not going to hit the sweet spot of where the future seemed to be. And yet, with the glitch, it sort of turned it into a different kind of work. And I'm grateful for that. It was kind of cool. I generally make work that is thematically old-fashioned, small, lyric. Most pieces at the intersection of gender and sexuality, definitely confessional, often in the first person. People always think it's me. It can't always be me. It's not. But the things we're not supposed to do in publishing or in academia. And I came to the realization, and Jessica and I have talked a lot about this, and I owe her a lot because she's been this fantastic sounding board as I try to think through, that I do have access to some very expensive equipment sometimes and the luxury to work with a variety of tools. And I was asking recently, was I unmoved to make more overtly computational work? Even at one time, I was working for a very large visualization center and really thought I should just be doing like incredible knowledge domain visualizations and sculptures. And I had to ask myself, am I uninterested or digging in my heels? And I think, actually, that my insistence on the feminist eye is, in fact, a tiny bit of a fuck you to the idea that I really should grow up and become more universal. A holding on to the certainty that women's voices and stories are still radical and that the universal story is never quite that. I resist the idea that it's not radical to put the things that traditionally and historically women have written, that putting them in a digital context and rethinking them using these tools is not radical. That the co-constitutive nature of the personal combined with the machine isn't somehow part of the avant-garde. So to end, feminist horizon. So one call to action is the feminist horizon as we go from strength to strength, acknowledging the important roles that feminist concerns have played in the establishment of this field, the incredible women who have given so much to this organization and to literature, and building on these, and of course. And at the same time, feminist horizons, I think, do demand, taking feminism seriously demands a sustained interrogation of the relative value assigned to the work women take up, the work gender does, the work whiteness does, the work English does. We need to look at how we reproduce ourselves, how we talk about ourselves as a field, to understand that our visualizations are not neutral. And thank you.
Well, I'm inspired. I also want to start with gratitude to Kathy for organizing this panel and for asking and prodding me to see the importance of feminism in my own work. Thank you. And for putting me on a panel with Caitlin Fisher, an avant-garde digital writer, no question about it, and pioneering feminist whose work I've admired for a very long time, but have not had the guts to close read and think about seriously. So today I'm stepping out of my comfort zone a bit, and I appreciate the opportunity and the company. So today I take Caitlin Fisher's Circle from an augmented reality work from 2012 as my tutor text for exploring how and why electronic literature demands feminist literary criticism. But first,
a bit of backstory. 2 years ago, at the ELO conference in Milwaukee, I shared early thinking about Fisher's Circle and some other works of electronic literature. And back then, I was focused on the role of remediated paper in electronic literature interfaces. And I argued that such nostalgic interfaces are symptoms of what I'm calling bookishness in a larger book project. And I used C.N. Nye's deconstructive and feminist argument about the aesthetic of cute to suggest that such objects, and Christine, I love your work here too, such objects use cute paper objects as an aesthetic of bookishness for feminist purposes. But feminism was not my main focus, and in all honesty, I really didn't know the implications of my own suggestion. And after my talk, Tasha Oren of the University of Milwaukee asked me to submit to her volume, The Rutledge Handbook of Contemporary Feminism. And I was shocked. I wasn't shocked because my work was solicited, but because it was to be included in a feminist volume. I just never thought of my work in such terms. I'm trained as a modernist, avant-garde, right? And a historicist and a formalist. And although I, of course, consider myself a feminist and am deeply inspired and shaped by feminist theory, and I'm very, very excited to vote in my country's presidential election, I never thought that my mode of close reading experimental literature counted or participated in feminist discourse. And yet, when Tasha asked, I had just resigned from an elite tenure track job for very personal reasons and was making choices that challenged the deeply embedded patriarchal and Cartesian values of the academy, which privilege rationality over embodiment and discourse over materiality. And it's only very recently that I'm able to see my personal choices as part of a research agenda, and indeed, a feminist one. So here I am. And today I return to Circle with a different perspective. And this is not a talk about bookishness. Today I want to argue that electronic literature, and Circle being my exemplary case, can offer opportunities for us to reconsider how we practice feminist literary criticism. And specifically, I argue that Circle offers object-oriented thinking that challenges contemporary philosophical trends such as object-oriented ontology, which proclaim the importance of things while disdaining the social and political realities in which things are actually materialized and embodied. So, you're all probably familiar with Circle, and if you're not, please do go look at the video documentation after. But let me remind you that it operates through embedded QR codes in analog objects, or in some versions on the left you see paper interfaces, and that the reader must scan these objects with a digital device. And I'm going to limit my talk today to the analog objects. In some versions, you use a virtual reality headgear to scan, and in others, an iPad. But either way, you read this work by selecting, holding, and even fondling hand-sized objects. And when you do, when you scan these objects, you access vignettes about four generations of women. Now, as we know, and as has been discussed in this conference, virtual reality headgear is usually donned to kill dragons and soldiers and to feel superhuman, right? Not to access the small, intimate stories of family and love. But Fisher confronts expectations of digital media and video games by employing this very technology to tell women's stories and to pursue feminist storytelling. Let's see how. Ooh, I need sound. Circle is about objects in networks. The objects in Circle operate within a digital circuit of programmed code, software, and hardware, and they also represent symbolic networks of interpersonal relationships. So the work thus promotes attention to the context through which matter comes to mean. In other words, Circle demonstrates how objects and people exist in relational networks, and it does so in ways that express and encourage a feminist epistemology of situatedness and positionality. We all know that feminist theory contends that material contexts matter, right? That specific cultural contexts and historical and sociopolitical inform experience and thus value judgments. But we often need a reminder, especially in the age of transcendental data, as Alan Liu calls it, wherein digital information appears disembodied and objects seem autonomous. Circle assists in this effort. In this work, a collection of small, personal, and domestic objects are arranged on a tea service tray or in a trunk, a bracelet, a piece of stationery, family photographs, a doll's head. Each of these contains a digital code that prompts the projection of an image or sound file that contains a fragment of the story. So the story is not presented as text to be read. And formally, the work is a hypertext, a network of vignettes about the narrator, her absent mother, her devoted grandmother, Jelly, and her baby daughter, Harriet. But Circle also tells of the things that these women shared and left behind. At the center of Circle is a woman who gives voice, literally, to the women in her life. Our narrator has recently become a mother and has acquired a newfound appreciation of the woman who raised her, Jelly. So Fisher places the reader in the position of an archaeologist, interacting with artifacts from someone else's life and excavating the stories attached to them, in this case, literally attached to them. Circle's objects are of a certain sort. They are small, personal, domestic, and feminine, and they are the stuff of homes and parlors, of makeup tables and jewelry boxes. They might be considered ephemeral or unimportant. But Circle puts these works on display and demands that the reader considers them anew through interaction with new media. So Circle is about these objects, and it operates through them. I just want to keep saying that because it's really important. So because of this, it both engages object-oriented thinking and also presents an artistic example of material feminism. Recent work in New Materialism, and specifically Material Feminism, this great book, shows feminist theory attempting to go beyond, quote, the impasse caused by contemporary linguistic turn to feminist thought, end quote. In Circle, there's no linguistic text separate from the technological and artifactual. The work thus presents an opportunity to consider and to critique contemporary theoretical trends that focus on matter but ignore materiality, and thus that forget the important insights of feminism. And I'm talking here specifically of object-oriented ontology. I know. But it's important to explain why, right? It's important to actually do the analysis of why we can critique them. Object-oriented ontology is inspired by a combination of Bruno Latour's actor network theory and Quentin Meillassoux's speculative realism. And it attempts to circumscribe or downright reject the historically central role of humans in ontology. Graham Harman, a leading thinker in the field, explains the intervention thus, quote, the human world relation is treated as extra special, different in kind from the relation of cotton and fire, and this is the heritage that must be abandoned, end quote. Triple O asserts that real things exist distinctly from humans, and that they can also act distinctly from humans too. So such thinking challenges us to reconsider a philosophical tradition that is anthropocentric, and it prompts us to think, or to speculate, to use their terms, about objects without human subjects. Now, I think there's actually a lot to be excited about here in object-oriented ontology, specifically in its creative effort to speculate and think of ways to retool traditional modes of thinking about objects through and the imagination, right? Through literary in some ways. But there's also a lot to be concerned about. And these concerns reverberate with central tenets of traditional feminist critique. Specifically, that bodies, whether they're animate or inanimate, are always constituted by actual situations and histories. So object-oriented ontology asks us to consider objects without the human. But such extractions, I would argue, are more about hiding or privileging certain priorities over others, rather than actually thinking outside of the anthropocentric box. Let's explain by looking at Circle. So Circle's an object-oriented work, and its narrative depicts key moments in the development not only of its human subjects, but also of its inanimate objects. This work tells stories of how these things arrived at a place where they could be held and scanned. In this case, the readers of Circle are both animate and inanimate, right? The digital is, the computer is also reading. The scenario might be a perfect place to promote object-oriented ontology's idea of object agency. And indeed, Circle seems to render its objects as autonomous agents that literally contain their own stories, regardless of if a human reads them. They still have these digital scanners, these digital codes that have their stories. Yet, Circle also depicts these objects as existing in complicated contexts of mediation, symbolism, and the symbolism is quite important here, right? And emergence. And in so doing, this is a work that challenges attribution of autonomy and agency to objects. Take, for example, the golden bracelet, a central component of Circle's menagerie and its narrative.
Let me hold on. Whoever wore this had a bad heart. You can still hear it beating.
The narrator tells us the jelly's mother, quote, has a bad heart and dies when my grandmother is 10, end quote, leaving Jelly to be raised by her own grandmother. Jelly wears her mother's gold bracelet as a kind of memorial. The story presents the bracelet as a figurative metonym for a lost mother. But it is more material and artifactual than that. The narrative tells us that the psychic told Jelly, let me hold that, the psychic says. Whoever wore this has a bad heart. You can still hear it beating. The thump, the thump. So the bracelet is not just a symbolic representation. It actually contains the beating heart of Jelly's dead mother. And when we, the readers, hold the bracelet, we hold in our hands the heart of the story, literally and figuratively, right? The trauma of losing one's mother. We also hold the connection between Jelly and her narrator, for the story shows us that the central loss of a mother is what connects these two women and makes them who they are. So we learn this through the transmission of information from a mother's body to a bracelet, from a bracelet to Jelly, from Jelly to the narrative, and from the diegetic narrative to the analog object that we readers hold in our hands. The bracelet is a circular symbol for infinity and repetition. Its center is void, but as Circle shows, emptiness and loss can serve as cornerstone for growth and connection. We're told that the bracelet now adorns the narrator's wrist and dangles in front of her daughter, Harriet. Quote, grabs my bracelet with a hidden heartbeat. You can still hear it beating. The thump, end quote. Just, I love that so much. We, the readers of Circle, who now actually hold the bracelet in our hands, become part of this circle of women by interacting with their things. It's not only stories about women that make Circle, that posit Circle's feminist perspective, but also its material feminism. The work presents a context for humans and things to interact, an opportunity to consider how these objects and people arrive in a particular moment wherein they can interact. So let me just explain. Circle's narrative tells us the stories of how a few women became who they are and how a few things arrived where they are. The work shows us these sedimented histories, right? The histories of labor, of movement, of distribution and sharing. And these histories, Circle suggests, enable and inform our interactions with objects in ways that shape our interpretations of them. So to quote Sarah Ahmed, who Stephanie Bullock quoted earlier in the conference, orientations matter. Ahmed writes, quote, what is reachable is determined precisely by orientations we have already taken, end quote. In other words, immediate experience is always part of a longer history of interactions and situations. And this is, I think, what Caitlin was just talking about in terms of the history of the field as well, right? It's not immediately visible, but there is a history there. Ahmed writes, quote, orientations are about the directions we take that put some things and not others in our reach, end quote. So a focus on orientation, rather than on actors or actions or settings, allows us to see the relationships between things, Such a focus also allows us to see how past orientation leads to present situation, how we can actually historicize and understand the present, the contemporary, as having history, right? We can thus recognize that objects are not isolated and discrete, but are always interconnected and historically situated. Circle enacts this idea by presenting objects that seem to be autonomous agents, but these things not only contain their own histories of arrival, but also histories that are imprinted by and inseparable from those human stories of arrival as well. Just think of the bracelet. Or you can also think of the glitch aesthetic in this work, which Caitlin mentioned briefly.
In story, I tapped the message Jeff wrote in Fake Morse code. We both like Fake Morse code very much.
I won't spend a lot of time talking about glitch, although it's part of the longer chapter. But circle is intentionally glitchy, and it uses the glitch to make explicit the importance of orientation. Because the glitches in this work remind us that we readers need to physically orient ourselves in relation to the objects and the digital scanner in order to actually access the narrative. The glitches, of course, also signify gaps and hidden histories in the stories that we access, parts of the sound file that we can't hear, and the larger other stories that we'll never know. So glitch turns our attention to the larger infrastructural systems, both technological and cultural, that are involved in mediating our lives and experiences. Let me just conclude by saying, by restating my argument, that Fisher's Circle uses advanced technology to tell a very simple story of female bonds, but it is also a deeply philosophical engagement with objects and object-oriented thinking, one which illuminates the importance of materiality. Circle is about tensions between human readers and analog objects, between those objects and the digital devices that scan them, between the transmedial format and the literary performance that it produces. Circle aestheticizes and is dependent upon situatedness, that central component of feminism. And it is in ways that model and also demand renewed modes of feminist literary criticism for digital literature. Thank you.